Chicago. This is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by Democrat Michael Bauer, Republican Jeannie Ives, Progressive Celine Mulkill, and Republican Chris Roebling. Our program tonight coming to you from our brand new studios at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, the Paul and Angel Harvey Radio Center, to be exact. It's nice to have you with us. Phone lines open, 1-800-723-8029. If you'd like to email me a comment, it's brucedumont@museum.tv. If you want to tweet me a comment, it's @Dumo. And again, if you want to join us on the World Wide Web, it's beyondthebeltway.com. It is not only this week's show, but past shows as well. And again, you can join us live on Facebook as well as on YouTube. So you can find us just about anywhere. And I want to thank at the beginning of the show, I want to thank Fritz Goldman and Sam Greenberg and Justin Kolubsik and all the people, Big City Sets, Chuck Grandis. I want to thank all the people who've been working for the last 3 weeks and putting our new studio together while we did this broadcast from our flagship station, WIND, in Elk Grove Village. But we're back in our new home. And again, we hope you enjoy both the radio and television version of our show for tonight and for many, many years to come. We've got lots to talk about. We always do. I want to begin by talking about tariffs. So when I ask Jeannie Ives, who's one of our conservative Republicans tonight, Jeannie Ives, are you worried that those that supported Donald Trump may end up on the short end of the stick come 2020 on the tariffs issue?
Well, I'll tell you what I'm not worried about. I am not worried about those folks who are farmers and agriculture industry folks. I'm not worried about them not voting for Donald Trump in 2020. I think he will be returned to office in 2020. I think those folks are going to vote for him regardless of the tariff situation. And here's why. First of all, we're an agricultural state. In fact, for Illinois, and this is broadcasted from Chicago. So in Illinois, you know, agriculture is our number one industry. It's a $17 billion industry. Over 50% of our soybeans, though, however, go out to China. And so it has hurt them. I'm not saying it hasn't hurt them. However, in December and then again earlier this year, Donald Trump did send those guys about $1.50 in support for their crops on soybeans and stuff like that. So they basically, if they had sold at that time,
when you say
they
were going to make $1.50, what do you mean by that?
Two different payments, 68 cents each per bushel on their soybeans. So, okay. You know, basically the farmers that I've talked to say, look, if I got soybeans and I can get $10 a bushel, I'm going to be fine with that. And he brought them up to about that amount. And I know that the cost is down now, but the farmers that I say, they want fair trade, and they're willing to stick through it with Donald Trump while he gets the deal done.
I want to talk to Michael Bauer. You're a card-carrying Democrat. Michael, nice to have you with us. Great to have you back. To what extent are the tariffs an important issue for the Democrats in this campaign?
Well, I imagine that some of the Democratic candidates will try to make the tariffs a big issue, but I'm going to be surprising you with my statement. You know, we have gone for decades with China engaged in stealing our intellectual property, with pouring into the marketplace, global marketplace, counterfeit goods, and Democratic presidents and Republican presidents have never done anything about the so-called China trade problem. And I have to tell you something. I don't know whether the tariff situation will work or not, but I give Donald Trump credit that he's at least willing to tackle the problem and try to resolve it.
Chris Roebling, you travel around the world. What are they talking about around the world as regards to tariffs? And where do you come down as to whether or not this going to be a net plus or a negative for the president in reelection time?
Well, I think I was just in the Middle East and then in India and then in Hong Kong before coming back. And I guess what I understand, what I hear is amazement that an American administration is taking these issues on and is doing so both with a growing economy, which strengthens our hand, and with someone who understands economics, who is President Trump. So was this unexpected by virtually everyone? I think it was as unexpected as Trump winning. Is it going to hurt him? I don't think it is going to hurt him because I believe, as Jeannie is reporting, the folks in these affected industries have been hurt, as Michael says, literally for decades. And they're seeing somebody step up, and they know there might be a little more pain between here and resolution, but actually the Chinese economy, I don't want to say faltering in a existential sense, but it's sputtering, okay? We are growing. Right now they need us more than we need them. And so Trump has created an ideal situation in which to make these claims.
Does the president have to have a conversation with his base, basically? I mean, some of these people, I saw some of the farmers on one of the network newscasts last week, and they basically said, for national security purposes and for the good of the country, they were willing to take a hit. Is that part of the sacrifice that Donald Trump has got to make a reference to?
Well, honestly,
that everybody's got to sacrifice and wrap himself in the flag on it?
I think this is a big issue for them. However, it's interesting because these are the same farmers that also do need some immigrant help to bring in their crop. So he could actually, in some ways, be more generous on that way through work visas or whatever he needs on that mm-hmm. thing. So he could help them in that way. But look, his surprise supports are going to be higher than what he offered last year to help these farmers through this thing. That's a huge boon to them. And the farmers that I talked to said there's a couple things in the last 2 years also. There was an oversupply of production to begin with, which means that the prices were going to be depressed. They've also have other issues right now with spring planting being off because it's been very wet here. They've had the floods that have affected Nebraska and Iowa. So all of this they take into context. So it's not simply the tariffs, and they know that. That said, what Donald Trump can get them on a tariff deal and on a trade deal is he can actually open more markets to them, which is really the end goal here. And so they're willing to stick with him.
And on a fairer basis.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I think that's the key issue that we have to keep in mind. Everyone's looking for a fair trade deal. And we don't have one right now with China.
On another issue, the immigration speech last night or last week in the Rose Garden, was that a speech for someone that wants to get something done, or was that the speech of a person that wants a great issue for 2020, Michael?
It's a speech. It's a great political issue.
Does everybody agree with that? Does anybody think that's going to lead to any?
I believe it's a great example of how the Democrats have managed to paint themselves into a corner by mindless opposition, by this so-called resistance to everything, and a refusal to engage. They don't have to engage with Trump so much. They don't even have to engage with the Republicans in Congress. I mean, ultimately they have to, but the Democrats should be engaging with regular people and their lived experience in this economy. And I believe folks are, if they did that, they would be giving some votes to Trump the way that Tip O'Neill mm-hmm. allowed some votes to go over,
you know,
to Reagan.
I have to tell you something.
We got to pause. I'm going to let you do that in a moment. 1-800-723-8289. From coast to coast and border to border, I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for joining us tonight on Beyond the Beltway.
A line is a powerful thing. It connects the global economy to your living room. Cleaner air to stronger markets. Factory floors to less crowded roads. Today's progress to tomorrow's promise. Norfolk Southern. One line, infinite possibilities.
Bruce Dumont, thanks very much for joining us tonight. Salim Moulkill has joined us, who's running a little bit late with a little problem we ran into downstairs of our brand new studio. Salim, I'm going to bring you up to speed. Mm. We were talking about the tariffs, and we were also talking briefly, primarily about the tariffs and how they play in various communities. Is the tariff an issue that your listeners to WVON radio care about? Do they talk about the tariff issue very much?
No, not much, unless some connection is made with retail
price rises. And, you know, people have been talking about Walmart's dependence on China and how that might mm-hmm. affect, you know, some of the audience that shops at Walmart. Mm-hmm. But other than that, there's really not been that much discussion yeah. about it.
Now, one of the other really big issues last week was the legislature in Alabama, a very restrictive abortion law signed by Governor Ivey. And there's seven other states that have varying degrees of abortion bills that have riled up, obviously, the pro-choice community. And again, I want to come back on a political issue now, because Jeannie, mm-hmm. you've been very active in the Right to Life movement for a long time, as has Chris Roebling. Is this the way you want this issue dealt with now? You'd like to see Roe v. Wade overturned, would you not?
Well, certainly I'd like to see it. I think it was an overreach by the federal government with something that should probably be decided at the state level. And I think that's generally what most conservatives or Republicans believe, that essentially this is not something that's set in constitutional. I have the constitutional right to an abortion, and that it's best left up to the states to decide what level abortion restriction you're going to have. And, of course, the more knowledge we've had about abortion, its effects on the human life inside the woman, the mother, and everything else, the more that we know about the pain threshold, the more that we know about when the hearts start beating and all that, the science has informed what we know more about the abortion issue. And I think that you've seen, really, Americans become far more pro-life and certainly want to reject the extreme abortion bills that you've seen from New York, the thoughts that have happened in Virginia, the comments by Governor Northam about essentially infanticide. That is, to us, very extreme.
But again, Pat Robertson said that he thinks the Alabama law was maybe a little too extreme, went too far. Chris, what's your take?
What the heck is wrong with Alabama saying something? What the heck is wrong with New York saying something? This is democracy. These are the laboratories. I agree with Jeannie. You know, what came out of New York and what came out of, in my opinion, Virginia was abhorrent, I think, to any sense of decency and concern about the absolutely vulnerable life within, okay? And when we have Governor Northam talking about, well, we can have the baby out and then the mother makes a decision, then we'll act, that, I mean, it is infanticide. So now Alabama has spoken. I don't think that what Alabama did is any worse than what New York and Virginia did. I think Alabama is trying to uphold the rights of these absolutely, you know, vulnerable preborn human beings.
Michael, where do you come down on this issue? Okay. And again, the politics of it.
We have two extremes here. We have one extreme where I don't think anyone wants an abortion on demand. And the other extreme is I think most people want women to have the right to get an abortion under certain circumstances. So who should decide where those parameters are? Frankly, I think politicians are the worst possible people to decide this, because they have no clue what they're talking about.
But they're the ones that do decide it.
I'm sorry?
But they are deciding it.
Well, they are deciding it, and they're screwing it all up. I mean, I don't want to... Listen.
Well, I want to see,
know,
Michael,
if
respect,
you want to think was, Governor was, Northam saying a woman 8.5 months pregnant should be able to have an abortion. Well, of course, that's insane.
Thank you.
Okay. I want to get Salim's response as well. Salim, again, your experience with your callers, I mean, a lot of African Americans are very religious people. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of African Americans who live in Alabama. Mm-hmm. The perception in the media is that African Americans are pro-choice, but I don't know mathematically whether that's true or not.
No, it's not. I don't think it's true at all. But what African Americans all worry of is the fact that this anti-abortion fervor is coming primarily from the red states. And so they connect that the kind of racist attitudes that tend to be prevalent in these states with this anti-abortion fervor. And they are very suspicious of this. A lot of them suspect that it is primarily a kind of demographic anxiety that is leading a lot of these white politicians to be so adamant in their rejection of abortion. Although the people who would suffer, who would most likely have the most aborted fetuses would be African Americans, because
right.
they tend to be.
That is absolutely right. Mm-hmm. This is eugenics. That's how abortion started with Margaret Sanger. And we all know that. And that's where they Planned Parenthood intentionally puts their facilities in minority communities.
So why do you?
It's not right. It's not fair.
That's the racism.
Yeah, that's the racism.
Why do you think
right
there are people who really don't seem to care much about Black lives and in other ways?
Of course,
I don't agree with you. I think that
premise.
I reject that premise.
You reject
too.
That premise?
Yeah, absolutely. We're the ones who
talk,
argue
if
for.
If you talk to Black people in the South,
they
would say, "Are you crazy? We live among these races. We every day we experience this kind of discrimination. How can you possibly say that that's not true? It's incredible. Actually."
First of all, African Americans used to be Republicans. In fact, they were
definitely the party of Lincoln. Exactly.
The Republicans are the party of civil rights. Republicans are the party of Lincoln.
That's
the ones
true.
Who abolished slavery.
Used to be before
the ones
became,
who became 14th.
Before the Southern Strategy.
You need to quantify that. You need to qualify that. You need to absolutely tell us exactly where you see the racism.
Southern Strategy.
We're also the ones. Do you know why Florida
the
won?
The modern Republican
Party
was built on racism.
Do you know why Florida went Republican governor? The Republican governor won in Florida because of the voucher program that he put in place so that minority and poor children could get a shot at a good education in the private sector.
Jeannie,
that's why he did that.
Poor women, poor Black women in Alabama and Georgia will not be able to get abortions in those states. And that means that they have to find the funds to travel to a state where they will be allowed to get an abortion, and they don't have the funds because they are more economically disadvantaged.
They can choose adoption.
Or they will be vulnerable to these backdoor abortions, which is also likely.
It's a human life. I don't understand why you want to disavow the potential of a human life. I don't understand that. I would rather, if you're going to call me an extremist, I'm going to tell you that I'd rather stand on life and the potential for that life to exist and to grow and to produce wonderful things for the future.
Chris Roebling. I believe that this is the gravest of all subjects, I think. And I believe that this is the most significant subject in the political forum today. And it is, I'm just back from Harper's Ferry, as a matter of fact, in addition to all that other stuff. And I can tell you, having been to where John Brown stood, I think that what has been happening between New York and Virginia and Alabama, I think that the activism of folks who see the Democratic Party accepting extremism at the cost of these vulnerable lives, I believe that is one of the most significant elements in what I think is going to be, and I've been doing my tally, Michael and I were talking about a 40-state, I think it's about 35 to 38 states that Trump is going to win next year. And I think this is one of the keys.
Hmm. I will tell you, though, someone like me looks at Alabama, looks at the law just passed in Missouri, looks at some of these other states who are passing heartbeat laws, et cetera. And I view that as incredible extremism.
I think women in this country will reject, for the most part.
We'll see.
We're going to see. But the original decision, the overreach that was referred to by Jeannie, you know, you had all those guys on the Supreme Court. We didn't have any of the understanding of the neonatology that we do today.
Yes.
And I think that men and women and children, and you're seeing activism among high school students and college students, like
on both sides. On both sides.
Well,
you are saying on both sides.
The question I'm asking is this the issue we want to dominate a presidential campaign? I don't think President Trump wants this issue.
Has it ever? I don't think it. I think it's always been of vital interest to the folks on both sides.
But it's usually about who is going to be appointed to the Supreme Court. That's the way it's been for the last, three or four cycles.
I will say this. In some circles, it's a litmus test.
But
on both sides.
And so
that good or bad? That's why we're having this discussion right now.
Right. It's because
Bernie Sanders was asked by Chuck Todd today. I meet the press. Is this a litmus test for you?
And he said yes.
Yeah, but
the Democrats have been wrong.
Not definitively at all.
This is a great example of where the Democrats have falsely described the situation on the Republican side. They have said that it was a litmus test for us, and in fact,
it's really a litmus test for them.
Exactly.
You have one.
You have the
Chicago Representative Dan Lipinski, whose wife I happened to see Friday night at the Illinois Right to Life banquet. 800 people, place was packed. Trey Gowdy was the featured keynote speaker. Okay. He's the only one in the Democrat Party who will stand for life. Right. And he's being ostracized. And now, once again, what is your party doing? You are primarying him over. You're primarying him over for the abortion issue.
Actually, what's interesting, though,
But the party is saying they didn't last time in the primary.
They learned their lesson last time in the primary. They figured out that they had to stick with him, but he's still being primaried, which says a lot.
Let me also point out, Bob Casey,
we got to be back
shortly.
With instant acceleration, electric cars are more fun to drive and more affordable than ever. Electric cars are here. Plug in to the present.
Dallas, St. Louis, Nashville, Tuscaloosa. All major cities to feel the destruction caused by a direct hit from a tornado. Is Chicago next? It's not a question of if, but when, and the clock is ticking. Learn what to do now at ready.illinois.gov to become tornado ready.
Bruce Dumont back at the Paul and Angel Harvey Radio Studio at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. And again, we're working out of the Art LeBeau control room. Mr. LeBeau is a member of the Radio Hall of Fame. He's the man who came up with the idea of oldies but goodies. Oldies but goodies. And by the way, speaking of rock and roll, let me mention that this coming Friday, we're opening the latest exhibit here at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. It's produced in association with the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland, Ohio. It's called Louder Than Words, and it's about the relationship of rock and roll and politics. The exhibit is already up, so our guests around the table this evening will be the first on their block to see it. But come on down. It opens up. It's $18 for adults. Come on down. It starts. It's going to run here for several months. But again, it's a very well done. If you're interested in politics, if you're interested in music, or if you're interested in just museums, I think there's really is something for everybody. It talks about the protest songs of does anybody remember their favorite protest song? Now, again, to our Republicans, do you remember the Ballad of the Green Beret? I mean, what do you remember?
Blowing in the Wind.
I'm not too young.
Joan Baez stepped on my foot in a march in Washington in about 1975.
Okay.
She stepped
That's
on my
claim
foot.
To fa-
and
That's
she,
your claim
it,
to
well,
fame?
Well, it's my claim to fame. And she looked at me with those big eyes of hers, and she said, I'm so sorry. And I was like, you can step on another one. It's okay.
You probably were on the left at that time.
You were not the last person whose toes she stepped on.
I was actually in my transition, 72 to 76. Okay. I was questioning my Democratic upbringing.
Were there protest songs? I mean, obviously, we deal with a black.
Marvin Gaye, what's going on? Also, Woodstock, Joni Mitchell. I mean, that was one of my favorites.
Do you remember any?
War. Yep. What is it before?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you remember Eve of Destruction?
Yes.
Eve of Destruction
was one of the first songs to be banned by.
I was in a service.
Rock and roll station. That was like. The lyrics to that were like, you couldn't believe that they were actually on the radio.
That's right.
I tell you, I helped throw up a barricade and showed and wrote at Northwestern University in May of 1970.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah.
Well, this was...
Yeah, I was a rebel in those days.
Well, I know. Well, then the Ballad of the Green Beret came out, which was the response to eve of destruction. And so anyway, these are some of the stories that you will hear and see depicted at Louder Than Words. It's going to run through the summer here at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. I think you will all like it if you're coming to the city of Chicago. Let's let our Republicans now take a moment and introduce themselves. And we'll begin with Jeannie Ives.
I'm Jeannie Ives. I'm a former state representative from Illinois, former gubernatorial candidate on the Republican side. And we are talking about abortion tonight. And I do sit on a PAC board for Illinois Right to Life.
And Chris Roebling.
My name is Chris Roebling, and it's great to be in this inaugural use of the Paul and Angel Harvey studio. It's been my privilege to be on the program down through the years, and
long time.
Really appreciate it.
And let's meet our Democrats, or our progressives this evening. Let's start with you, Salim Muwakkil. More of a progressive than a Democrat.
Yeah, I guess you can say that. Salim Muwakkil, I'm a long-time participant in Beyond the Beltway, 25 years, in fact.
Yes.
Something like that. So,
but you had gray hair then.
Yeah, I've had gray hair since I was about 25, really. That's a sign of wisdom. Those are my chevrons. That's how
yes,
I look
right,
at it.
Right.
I'm happy to be here in this inaugural episode.
Very good. And Michael Bauer.
And I am Michael Bauer, and among other activities, I'm the co-chair of the State of Illinois Holocaust and Genocide Commission, and I'm just coming off being chair and the finance chair for the successful campaign by Lori Lightfoot to be mayor of Chicago.
And she is sworn in tomorrow.
And she is sworn in tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
We'll have a new mayor. National attention.
Yeah. Indeed.
I think we probably agree we're probably sort of excited about this, whether we're Republicans or Democrats. There is a significant change in Chicago, hopefully, starting
a new era
tomorrow morning.
Chicago might be ready for reform.
Well,
we're
going to
find out.
We're just celebrating that Obama's leaving.
Yeah, there's a lot of celebration of that. I want to talk more about the abortion issue. Obviously, is a hot one. It will continue to be a hot one. But I want to go to our Democrats and find out how do you, as Democrats, deal with this issue? Because I would assume that obviously in your base, it's probably overwhelmingly against the Alabama law.
Yes.
I mean, abortion has been an important part, or pro-choice position has been important to you for almost 30 years now. So my question is there any variation of that issue that a Democrat can get away with and discuss? I mean, if a Democrat were to say, as the president said, and as Ronald Reagan has said, I believe in abortion with the exception of the life of the mother, which is what it says in Alabama,
right, right.
As well as rape, as well as incest, which it does not say in Alabama. Is that a position that a Democrat could survive with in a presidential campaign? I'll start with you, Mike.
I don't think so. I think the party, rightfully or wrongly, is at a point right now where I think you have to be 100% pro-choice to be an effective candidate, to be a viable candidate.
Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think so. I think it comes down to this question of a woman's right to her own autonomy. And when it comes to those issues, even African-Americans who are, for the most part, anti-abortion, they still treasure this freedom of a woman's choice. And if that's because, you know, we've seen, we have a history of when the government has kind of abrogated the choices of people and, you know, segregation. You can't go here. You can't. So there's a reluctance to accede to that kind of legislative fiat.
So how do they respond to the Louisiana governor, you know, Governor Edwards, who, as he prepares to sign a heartbeat bill in Louisiana, is a Democrat? So you've got these folks who actually don't adhere necessarily to the party construct that abortion on demand at any time is what you want. The perception of what you have presented as, well, we don't really believe in late-term abortion, but really your party and all of the candidates out there for president on your side, they have taken those extreme positions on abortion.
I never said I didn't believe in late-term abortion. I'm aware of the circumstances under which women in their seventh and eighth month have to get an abortion, when they discover that the fetus has no brain, when they discover the fetus has a spine that's outside the fetus's body, when they discover that they are diagnosed with an advanced case of cancer and have to start chemotherapy right away.
Okay, so those are sort of red herrings when we talk about the abortion debate. Those are very much red herrings. But first of all, it's less safe to actually perform an abortion than it is to deliver the baby and let the baby's life go as it may go, as God has granted it to go. And I've been through that.
Okay.
I've been through that where I at the 20-week ultrasound, I knew that my baby was not going to live.
Okay.
And so we delivered naturally at about 8.5 months when it was time to be born, and he died in my arms after 45 minutes. But actually, it's more risky to the mother in those late terms to perform an abortion than it is to deliver that child and let nature take its course, if it's that way, or to put it up for adoption or whatever else. That is actually the case. So it's a red herring that's ever necessary if you talk to anybody.
But whose decision is it to make? Should it be the woman and her OB/GYN, or should it be the government making that decision?
Yeah. Chris, it's
a human life. It's a human life, and we protect human life.
Yeah, I think what is fascinating at the root of today's issue is that, say, the pro-life movement for the last 25 years has consciously pursued an incrementalist strategy. And so the strategy of the pro-life movement has been to identify circumstances in which a broad range of society, not to say activists on the pro-choice side, not to say Planned Parenthood, not to say Democrats who need the funding and the support of the Planned Parenthood pro-choice abortion industrial complex, but to say the pro-life movement has identified situations like parental consent or parental notice, or informed consent. They've looked at specific situations in which the Democratic Party, I think to its everlasting detriment and shame, has in every case said, if we agree with this, then we will somewhere lose the right to an abortion. And that, I believe, is the principal cause for the divisiveness of this issue in national politics. Democrats were unwilling because Planned Parenthood and the funding network behind it were unwilling to grant any exceptions. And incrementalist strategy that was used by the civil rights movement on the one hand was then adopted by the pro-life movement in sort of the 1990s here in Chicago at Americans United for Life. And that has come over the last 25 years, borne enormous fruit, no pun intended, for the pro-life movement. And frankly, that's why there's so much traction on its side of the conversation today. And Democrats are becoming, in my opinion, more and more extreme in their reaction.
Wait a minute. That's not why there's so much traction on this issue. There's so much traction on this issue because Anthony Kennedy no longer sits on the United States Supreme Court, and Brett Kavanaugh does. And with Gorsuch and Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court, The pro-life community thinks that it has an opportunity to either significantly chisel away at Roe versus Wade or overturn Roe versus Wade, which is why all these states are passing laws now, you know, trying to get something up to the Supreme Court.
I just want to say,
but actually, on the New York side, they're the ones who started the extremism. Yes, where we have a reaction. You have another reaction to that. So it's a combination.
Okay.
We got to pause. 1-800-723-8289. Back shortly.
If you look hard enough, go off the beaten track far enough, you'll find an America teeming with the unusual, the odd, the downright strange.
I'm Will Klinger, and I'm your guide on a package tour we like to call
Wild Travels.
Join us on our weekly road trip to see America's most offbeat and unusual attractions. Wild Travels. Available on your local PBS station. Or it darn well should be.
When
as CSX moves forward, so do the rest of us.
Stand by. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. I don't think that was on the air.
Okay.
When you were talking about somebody was an absolute idiot.
Not.
You'll just have to figure out who that might be. I want to come back to an issue, but I want to let Celine kind of weigh in on it, and that is the president's decision that his new plan for legal immigration, and he wants to turn the system into a merit system, mm-hmm. not based on families, not totally. There's a percentage that will be, but he's basically arguing that, you know, there's people who have merit. We want them in the United States. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't shun them. And he basically said, we don't want to wage war against brilliance or genius. Mm. Do you agree with him on that?
I agree. We shouldn't wage war against brilliance, no doubt. But, I mean, at the same time, it's a sort of a restrictive position that he's
is
taking.
Is merit a bad word for you like it is for Nancy Pelosi?
It's not a bad word for Nancy Pelosi either. I don't think. I think
she said it was.
Well, she's saying that when it's used as a litmus test or as some sort of barrier, then it's right. It becomes a bad word because it's just like, you know, the how many beans in a bottle, you know, that black people had to count to vote once upon a time. Knowing how to count is not a bad thing. Mm-hmm. But knowing how to count beans in a bottle is not a productive exercise.
Is merit a good word for you to use, Chris Roebling?
Absolutely. And I think this is, again, this is a case where the Democrats are painting themselves into a corner. They're refusing to discuss the real issues that are confronting Americans. Jeannie already talked about our need for, relatively speaking, low-skilled workers. And, you know, that was part of Simpson-Mazzoli. That was part of Reagan's plan with the Democrats, and then the rest of that wasn't funded, as a long story. Trump is acknowledging that we're going to need people with, relatively speaking, fewer skills, and we need a lot of people with higher skills, and all of the people
who could also take jobs from Americans.
No, actually, when you get into the higher end, the HB1 visa programs, yeah. things like this, you're talking about people who are absolutely needed because we've got, don't forget, at this point, I've been out of the country for 2 weeks, but we're right now in a situation where we've got 7 million empty jobs mm-hmm. and only 6 right, million right. people roughly who are unemployed. Mm. Now, there's a whole nother group of people that aren't participating. But what Trump has done is said, we need a immigration system that benefits the American economy and the American worker. And that's what he's trying to deliver, and the Democrats ought to engage.
But Michael, but he's trying to deliver, but he, in his remarks in the Rose Garden, he left out two large groups of persons who have been the subject of the immigration debate. One are the Dreamers. There are 1.8 million Dreamers in this country, and the second is people covered by temporary protected status. Are we going to allow them to stay in this country or not? We gave them the opportunity to come to this country because their countries were in crisis, a variety of countries. There was about 300,000 to 400,000 of them. And the question becomes, what do we do about people covered by TPS? Mm-hmm. I think Trump's attitude, he's just going to send them all back.
And this is another area where the African-American community is a bit, they're a bit at variance with the traditional progressive view. And that is mm-hmm. a lot of black people do not approve of this kind of wholesale immigration policy. They would like restrictions on immigration because they feel that this especially in the lower income areas, that they are being kicked out of jobs.
Why does that not show up with members of the Congressional Black Caucus? I'm trying to think of any elected black official who is associated with a tougher stance on illegal immigration.
That's right? Because of this notion of a solidarity, third world solidarity, so to speak. If you oppress one people, then if you okay the oppression of one people, then you are essentially okaying the oppression.
Do you buy that?
I think that there's an issue of solidarity that's important to uphold.
But does that mean you want wholesale illegal immigration across the border?
Certainly
which is
not.
Why we're having this conversation and everybody's leaving out the word legal immigration.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
And,
that's right.
And you know, we're already still a very generous country when it comes to allowing folks to come in legally. We're the most generous country on the face of the earth, a million people plus come in every year.
And the notion of sanctuary city. A lot of black people are saying, well, why not sanctuary for, inmates, what's happening with mass incarceration?
Those people who are getting out of prison, do they feel that their jobs are being taken?
Yes, indeed.
Okay, because
this is an internal contradiction within the Democratic Party that needs to be exploited fully by the Republicans, who, generally speaking, and I say this as a loyal Republican after my switch in 1976, are too stupid to do it. Too stupid to exacerbate these internal contradictions. And I think, honestly, the guy who has shown more interest, notwithstanding Salim's, in my humble opinion, as a respectful friend of his for 25 years on this program, I don't buy that the Republican Party is racist because of the Southern strategy and Kevin Phillips, blah, blah, blah. We've had that conversation. I'm not going to get back into that. He has his position. I have mine. I'm telling you that the Democratic Party takes positions, whether it's with respect to Jewish people and Israel, with respect to African-American people and the economy, with respect to a lot of its base and the pro-choice issue, they're conflicted all over the place.
Sure.
And Democrats and Republicans are too stupid to exacerbate those.
Republicans are too. Republicans are.
I think less so. I think that our coalition actually is easier to keep together than the Democrats. The Democrats, for a lot of different reasons, not the least of which is competing for government benefits. But I think we have is the leave me alone coalition.
Wait, has the Democrat Party decided that there is a crisis at the border yet, the southern border or not?
Yeah.
Where are they on that?
They can't figure that out.
I think everyone agrees that there's a crisis at the southern border.
It is a crisis.
We just can't figure out what to do about it.
Okay.
And there's no proposals on what to do about it.
That's not true. Trump has had proposal after proposal.
What about the new plan?
And when you're talking about the Dreamers,
it's not a piece of legislation yet. But what did you think about the basic elements of his immigration plan?
Of his immigration plan, that we're going to change the ratios, that we're going to have skilled workers. And
that's part of it.
Okay.
And what changed the rules?
We discriminated even back at Ellis Island when people came through. There were all sorts of categories of discrimination as to whether or not you were going to be allowed in. Were you going to be productive? Did you have any diseases? Are you,
But we have a serious problem. First of all, we have a serious problem with Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador.
Hi, I'm April Jewell, a teacher in Ballard County School District in Kentucky.
Welcome to the world, 2116. You can fly across town in minutes, or across the globe in under an hour. Whole communities are living on Mars, and solar satellites provide Earth with unlimited clean power. In less than a century, Boeing took the world from seaplanes to space planes, across the universe and beyond. And if you thought that was amazing, you just wait.
Today, fresh fruits and vegetables will go from a field in California to a grocer in Miami. A bottle of beer from Eagle Pass will journey to a restaurant in Manhattan. A 2x4 in Oregon will find its way to a townhome in Denver. A hybrid will say goodbye to Detroit and hello to a showroom in Austin. While a steel beam will leave a mill in Illinois for a high-rise in Phoenix. And a flat screen in China will head to an electronics store in Memphis. Because today, as every day, wherever you find business, you'll find us.
Bruce Dumont back at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in our brand new studio, the Paul and Angel Harvey Studio. And also we're working out of the Art LeBeau Control Room and just a couple of other historic moments. This brand new set of ours was donated many years ago to the museum by WGN Radio, and this is the studio, and I am sitting where the legendary Radio Hall of Fame member Wally Phillips sat in this chair. Bob Collins sat in this chair. Spike Odell, Extension 720 with the late Milt Rosenberg, also used this studio. So this is a very memorable studio in the history of Chicago radio. But again, the funding for much of it came from Paul and Angel Harvey, and Art LeBeau provided the support from the control room. So again, all together, we're making this available for the where we do this program from. And we're also making it available for radio stations around the country. So if there are affiliates listening to this program this evening that would like to originate their show from Chicago at some point, certainly not on Sunday night between 6 and 8, but do let us know if you'd like to bring the show to Chicago. You can do it. And again, we're literally right outside the Radio Hall of Fame gallery here at the museum, which we'll show to you in the next several weeks. But again, nice to have you inaugurate, as well as our guest this evening, our brand new studio. I want to talk about Iran. I mean, how can you not get to it when there's been discussions and alleged plans of 125,000 troops, which the president says is way too many, too few rather. Jeannie, you are a military, you're a captain in the Air Force Reserve or Army Reserve.
Former.
Mm-hmm. And you have sons that serve this country. And my reaction to you, or my question to you, is where do you come down on Iran? I mean, you want to
look,
rattle the
I
sabers
think, you know,
or not?
Obviously, the first goal is deterrence, and that's a show of force. And so that's the first step that President Trump is taking, and I think that's the appropriate step. He's going to that region. He doesn't want another Benghazi, so he's pulled out some of the ambassadorial staff out of Iraq. I think that's appropriate, too. They from what I've read, have real solid intelligence that Iran is up to something. And maybe not them specifically, but the satellites that they actually, fund and give weapons to. So I think deterrence is obviously the first goal of the Trump administration, and that anybody who says that he's leading us right into the path of a ground war, I think that's hyperbolic at this point.
Michael Bauer, what's your reaction to the president's comments?
Well, I think I've said this before.
Comments?
First, I think the objective of our policy toward Iran should be a regime change.
Okay.
We should be doing everything possible to have the Iranian people oust the mullahs from their theocratic regime. That being said, I certainly don't think we want to go to another war, but I think the sanctions that we've imposed on Iran have been extremely effective, and I think if they could be tightened, they should be tightened.
Chris Roebling.
You know, Barack Obama actually imposed some pretty serious sanctions on Iran, and then they came to the table and he relented. And it was the senator from Illinois, Mark Kirk at the time, himself a United States Navy Reserve officer, said, no, we've got to tighten those sanctions, just like Mike Bauer is saying tonight. And that's exactly right. And that's exactly what President Trump has done. And the issue in the Middle East is, without a doubt, the single most important security issue in the Middle East is the ongoing kleptocracy. I mean, these people are miscreants. They are abusing. If it is not my place to say, as a Christian, it appears to me that they are abusing their religious offices, and there's a lot of evidence to support that. And they've got some very well-armed thugs who have also benefited from Barack Obama's fiscal largesse, okay, in the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. And so we've got a malefactor in the middle between our friends in the Gulf and our friend India, and we need to, I think, get them to different behavior. And if that ends up in regime change, hallelujah.
That's right, but it's not something that that we are going to exact on our own. This is something that we've got to call in the Saudi Arabia, Israel. They all have to be part of this solution.
Ooh,
this is not something that we're going to do on our own.
Who has Iran invaded? Who is Iran threatening?
Syria. Iraq,
they didn't have an invasion.
Lebanon.
So they've been invited by Assad. They've invaded Gaza. Is the only country in the region that has not invaded any other country.
That is just utterly false.
The Houthis are a Shia. That's why Iran is protecting them, because of the imperialism of the Saudis.
The Iranians have shipped arms.
The Sunni Shaubans who are creating ISIS.
I'm sorry.
And the whole Islamic revolution that we are the Islamist revolution that we all apparently are alarmed about, that's a Sunni production.
No, what we're alarmed about is Iran is getting a nuclear weapon. That's what we're alarmed about.
Iran is the only force that has been able to attenuate the march of ISIS.
I'm sorry.
That's why ISIS is out of Syria.
My friend, you got this.
Okay, now.
Come on,
Chris, you got this entirely wrong.
What is Iran?
Iran
is threatening, man.
Iran is threatening access to the Red Sea as it is threatening access to the Persian Gulf. Iran has
When have they?
They're doing so right. Why are they after Yemen? They don't care about Yemen.
There's almost always a small little of our allies agree with you.
Japan says Iran is a scare when they go through the Straits of Hormuz. Come on.
Let me tell you, the warmongering Americans are really incredible. This is not
warmongering. We're not warmongering. I'm the last person who's going to be a warmonger.
Yeah.
We thought Trump was that as well, but apparently he's changed his mind.
You are looking at, hold on. But the president said he hopes not when asked about whether there was going to be war. He says, I hope not.
Yeah. The way to avoid war is to show strength now so that they're not going to take steps that would lead to war. And I'll tell you, they have disrupted, without a doubt, they are busy disrupting Afghanistan. They have disrupted Pakistan. They have disrupted Iraq. They have disrupted Syria.
You're mixing things up here,
my friend. No, I'm not.
I'm not mixing things up. You're unaware of the sectarian differences. One at a time. I'm sorry. You're unaware of the sectarian differences. That's a grievous mistake on your part. I have made 30 trips
to the Middle East in the past 7 years, and I've got friends who are Shia, and I've got friends who are Sunni, and I'm not mixing those things up.
All right.
I am telling you that when you get your bags inspected at the Beirut airport, they are being inspected by Hamas personnel who work and are paid for by Iran.
You mean Hezbollah?
I'm sorry, Hezbollah.
Thank you.
And when you are talking about Libya, the Libyan situation has been destabilized by Iran. Iran is a principal malefactor, and they are dedicated to.
Who are these Sunni chauvinists? Who are the Wahhabis? What is the Wahhabi underlying principle that is driving ISIS? Have you identified that?
I think that there is a bit, I don't think that Saudi Arabia is invading Syria and Lebanon and
Yemen
and Gaza. I think Saudi Arabia is defending itself from Yemen.
Yemeni.
And I think that that's a very tough situation for our ally. I have been at the Riyadh airport when our technology has been shooting down rockets shot by 1-800-723-8289.
1-800-723-8289 is the phone number. Back with more heated conversation in a moment. Back in Chicago, and during the break, Michael Bauer, you made a point and started a little battle during the commercial break, so let's put it on the air.
Okay.
You said that the United States has a very important decision to make. What is that decision?
And the issue in the Middle East is, who would we rather get into bed with, the Saudis or the Iranians, recognizing that neither one is frankly a good player, neither one is a positive player. So the question is, not who is the better of the two, but who is the less worse of the two. And I think, from my perspective, I would much rather get in bed with the Saudis than the Iranians.
Okay, now we heard from Salim. He totally disagrees with that.
Yes, I disagree.
Let's hear from our Republicans. Let's say it's a binary choice. You got to choose one or the other. Jeannie Ives,
right now you have no choice but the Saudis. I mean, the Iranians run by the mullah and their entire theocratic
Saudis are not theocratic.
Well, of course they are, but at least they're friendly to us. They've actually let us hold ground while we took care of Kuwait. I mean, they've been friends that way. So, I mean, Iranians, you can't even deal with them. And we're like, we're not. We
let them murder a journalist.
We don't have shame. Well,
Saudis, right?
We didn't let them.
We didn't let them. They did that. They did that.
Down that chain. But we didn't want to tell you.
We didn't really pursue it.
No, look, there's plenty. That's why this is this is terrible. Yeah, it's a terrible choice.
If you want the Middle East to flourish, I'll tell you two things kind of in response. A, the Iranian people are among the most sophisticated, cultured,
indeed,
well-read, brilliant,
indeed,
cosmopolitan, open, interested, and interesting people you're ever going to find anywhere on the face of the earth. That's number one.
Okay.
And they're being completely suppressed by what they refer to in their parlance, in their expression, as, quote, the stupid regime. That's what they call it. The stupid regime is doing this. The stupid regime did that. And
we hear that in the United States as well.
We've got people over there who have their life savings on Tuesday is when they wake up on Thursday, it's worth a third of what it was on Tuesday. Why? Because of the galloping inflation that is underway because of the stupid regime. Okay. So one thing is
which is partly responsible because of our sanctions.
Sanctions are there to hurt the regime.
Yes. Yeah,
and there's going to be damage,
yes,
and but
there's
on the other
damage.
Side of all of this,
yes,
you've got people who can get liberated. And the second point is, I will say about the entire Middle East, in my humble opinion, the single most important issue in the Middle East is K-12 education.
Hmm.
K-12 education is the key to the Middle East, in my humble opinion, having had the privilege of going there 30 times in the last 6-7 years. You get kids learning at international standards. And I think the Middle East is going to have a blossoming of you already see it.
Will the Saudis allow that to happen?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I'm working on a STEM school in Mecca.
Do you think the Saudis will allow that to happen?
Because I think that the Saudis understand. I think that all of
the
Middle
East. They're the most restrictive of all, wouldn't you say?
They're not. No, they're not.
Okay.
They are becoming serially less restrictive. I mean, for instance, the religious police are no longer issuing citations, you know, on
the
street corner and things like this.
So here's the difference, though. What you brought up is really important. There's a difference between saying, well, we want to align with one particular government head, Iranian or Saudi. And it's another thing to say the people.
Right.
Underlying all of this is the people and who, you know, what can we do for them?
Right.
And in Iran, basically, you have to stoke revolt.
Right.
To make
revolt.
Hold on a second. I want to say that
there's no flag to rally around in Iran.
In Iran,
Islamic flag.
Aline's point is that the United States is perceived as picking on Iran, even the stupid regime that they're talking about there.
Right.
Aren't the people going to rally around their stupid regime?
I don't think so. I agree with Chris that they are a fairly sophisticated society.
Who has never invaded anyone.
Well,
as opposed to the Iraqis and the other Sunnis.
All right.
The imperialistic Sunnis who
you
surround
You seem to have
them.
A thing against Sunnis, which well, I'm not, you know, I'm it's like say, having I'm, a thing I'm, against Lutherans.
I'm talking about
It's like having
history.
A thing against, you know,
I'm talking about history.
Conservative Jews
if you
as
look
opposed
at history,
to...
Let's let Salim talk.
If you look at history, the Sunnis are implicated by their imperialism.
I think that... let me tell you something. After Mary Jo, my first love is history.
Okay.
And I'm going to tell you, you have got to know that there has been a lot of bad stuff done in the name of every religion. Roman Catholicism, Lutheranism,
I'm talking about Shia
Sunni,
and Sunni.
Shia, and I don't think you should say Sunniism is the problem
Wahhabi
in the Middle East.
Wahhabi is the underlying
ideology. You've said so. I understand.
I haven't said it to the audience. I said it to you personally. Everyone to know what I'm saying.
But
the Wahhabi version of Islam is the animating ideology behind ISIS, behind the Taliban, behind all of these Islamist groups that we seem to be.
What was it, 19 of the hijackers were Saudi? Or
exactly.
Yeah, there are Shia extremists.
Where have they shown
folks,
up?
We have callers on the line, or a caller on the line. They've been waiting a long time. This is, I believe, Tom in Youngstown, Ohio, listening to us on WPIC out of Sharon, Pennsylvania. Go ahead.
Good evening, Bruce, and to your guests. You know, as far as the trade situation with China is concerned, why don't we just forget about trading with China? I mean, we started trading with them because they had 1 billion people, and we were trying to bring them into the family of nations. It hasn't worked. In fact, they weren't really customers. They aren't customers of ours. We're customers of theirs more than they are of ours. And I really think it'd be advantageous if we switched our trade situation to India.
Yes.
Not only for them, for us.
Who is this? Who is this caller?
This is Tom in Youngstown, Ohio.
By Tom, I just want to tell you, I want to tell you, Tom, I had a long conversation in India a few days ago.
Mahdi.
Exact same point. India is almost as big as China, and within this decade or next decade,
people.
It will have more people than China, 1.35 billion and growing.
Far more liberal.
Number one. Number two, it's a common law system. Number three, they've got a middle class there that is bigger than our entire population, okay? They speak English.
One big one?
And they vote. They vote. They are small D Democrats.
Let
Tom talk.
They are right on the border of China, and they've had feuds with China before. They are right next door to the Islam nation. Pakistan, in fact, was divided from India because of its Muslim predominancy. And on the other side of Pakistan is Afghanistan, and on the other side of that is Iran. Now, you've got a billion Chinese, you've got a billion Muslims, and you've got a billion Indians. And, you know, we can't continue to be the sheriff of the world. I think it's time we build up India, and both economically and militarily, and deputize them to take care of that, you know, at least to a certain extent, take care of that part of the world.
I just want to recommend a lot of respect for 5,000-year-old societies when we come from one that's sort of 450 years old. But I, having said that, I think that India is achieving an enormous amount. Its economy last year surpassed that of France. Okay, so India is now in sort of the top six or seven economies in the world, and it is only going to grow. And I agree, we've got a lot more in common. We've been through some dry spells in our relationships with India. That's a long story, far too much for right now. Now is the time to focus on India. And I also agree with the other thing Tom said. China has proven itself after people like Bill Clinton and people like George Bush and even Barack Obama went out of their way to embrace China, and to try to get China to join the community. China has proven itself to be a terrible partner, and
I have a question about India, and again, this is based on perception. I've not been there 30 times or 20 times or whatever, but
neither
based on perception.
Yeah,
the perception that I have of India, obviously, those from India who come to the United States seem to be very bright, very productive, and I don't know whether they go home or not, but I mean, they stay here and they appear to be productive, but with everything that India has going for them, why is there so much poverty? Why is the perception of the country is you've got water you can't drink, people are living on top of each other, and it's a cesspool of existence? That's my impression of what India is.
Okay.
Am I wrong?
I think that India is a very big story. It's a very big country. It's enormous physically. It's enormous in population. When I say that they've got a middle class bigger than our entire population in the United States, remember that there is another billion people behind that middle class that they've got to worry about and try to find a way to take care of.
Are they doing anything for those people?
Oh, I think the Modi government is, it would seem to me, and I'm very privileged to be a part, and I've got a visa, so I want to be respectful here. The Modi government is, I would say, something of a mixed blessing. You know, Modi has given in on some of the religious issues, and he has sort of promoted the religious dimension in ways that have caused some people to wonder if Gandhi's view of a secular India is going to survive.
It won't survive.
I believe that it will. There are other people who believe that it won't, but in any case.
So do you think it goes the way of Turkey, is what you're saying?
I think there are parallels between Erdogan and Modi, but I think Modi and his people are much more reasonable than Erdogan has proven to be. But I think that in terms of your big question about poverty, the economy there is growing rapidly, and I think that is what they have to do to eradicate poverty, which has been endemic for, as I say, 5,000 years.
Yeah.
Can I point out something else?
Oh, no.
Tom's talking.
Tom's still talking.
Oh, Tom, yeah, go ahead, Tom.
Okay, now it's my understanding they had a caste system there, and I don't know if it's still in existence or not, but we're talking about helping out the poor. Those jobs that went to China were jobs we didn't want because of the fact that, you know, they were low-skilled jobs, that sort of thing. So it would probably help their India's poor out, and, you know, then as you say, their middle class is there, they probably wouldn't want those jobs anyway.
Tom, so we've got a pause. Tom, you bring up a good point. We'll continue the conversation. Thank you for your call. We will roll on from Chicago in our new studios. Don't go away.
Death.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago, and Chris Roblin, continue with your point. You're making a point about Joe Biden and the problems that you see the Democrats making. I mean, you think they're making mistakes, but...
Like all of us and so much in life, Biden is a mixed blessing, but I think that Biden is right now a vessel for an expression of support by traditional Democratic constituencies in the neighborhoods across America who are not entirely comfortable with Alexandria or Ocasio-Cortez or Congresswoman Tlaib or, you know, some of these other, way that Nancy Pelosi has chosen to speak about issues such as immigration. And when she will not meet with the family members, the mothers of these individuals who've been killed by the El Salvadoran street gang that is now basically operating with impunity throughout a lot of the Eastern United States because of, I hate to say this, our own immigration policies.
Right.
She is denying that, she's denying those moms an audience, then I think people in the Democratic Party, self-selected, are saying, you know, I think this Joe Biden guy, you know, he reminds me of what we used to be like.
How do you, Michael, though, honestly, as a Jew, as somebody who is in charge of the Holocaust Museum here in Chicago, how do you square what you know with some of the Democrats at the national level and what they're doing to support Palestine and Hamas? How do you handle Ilhan Omar?
Listen, I have been very outspoken about my feelings about Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I think there is a battle raging in the Democratic Party, frankly, for the soul of the Democratic Party over the issue of Israel. Mm-hmm. I know some people think that it's a battle already lost. I tend to think we're talking about a handful of backbenchers, but it is a growing issue within the Democratic Party. But from my perspective, I don't want to see the Democratic Party go the way of Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party in England.
Right.
So I think this is a battle that needs to be fought.
Right.
I want to, since I'm looking at two Democrats who I think are going to disagree on this issue, let's talk about, Salim, I know you have strong feelings about the three Democrats referenced by Michael Bauer.
I think
you see them in a different light.
Well, I don't think there's any, I think it's conflating the issue to talk about the Holocaust and then talk about Gaza or the Palestinians. These are two completely different issues. And to try to connect them in some sort of anti-Semitic tandem, I think is almost intellectually dishonest, because there are some people, the Palestinians are fighting for their land that was completely disappropriated from them. They were disinherited of their own land, and so they're trying to fight for that. In Gaza, they're living in an outdoor prison, and are denied any kind of an amenity that civilized people should be expected to enjoy. And so they are in a state of suffering. And to compare that with what the Nazis did to the Jewish people and the Holocaust that they experienced, that is, to me, a grievous conflation. And I don't understand how we allow that to happen.
Michael?
And, you know,
I appreciate your words. I think you're absolutely right. I think there is an issue between Israel and the Palestinians that needs to be resolved. But when I hear people trying to compare this or some other issue to the Holocaust. Frankly, I just think, do people not understand what unimaginable horrors occurred 75 years ago? I mean, we had a mayoral race in Chicago where the campaign manager, one of the candidates, posted on Twitter a picture of Nazi guards on trial in Nuremberg and said they were following orders just like one of the mayoral candidates was following orders. And I, frankly, went berserk at this and not only texted the campaign manager, but I texted the candidate. I said, this is just unconscionable to try to devalue the Holocaust like that.
Yay, Michael Bauer.
Yeah.
Let me tell you, John McDermott lives on.
Where does the future of that debate within the Democratic Party go? Because every time one of these three representatives, primarily the representative to lead from
Well, I think a lot of people spoke up for her.
Yes.
The last time there was a general.
But every time she says anything, she's
by the right
a
lightning
rod.
By the right wing.
The national media picks it up. Because do they just want the battle? They want the fight?
They want the.
Well, it's good for ratings, number one. But the real problem is, you know, between the Israelis and the Palestinians, there has to be a political will on each side to want to come up with a peace arrangement.
That's true.
And I personally don't think the political will exists on either side, because I think each side has convinced itself that there could be a one-state solution where it takes over the entire land between the Mediterranean Sea and the Jordan River. And that is not, from my perspective, a practical a feasible solution.
You still support a two-state solution?
Yeah, absolutely.
Since we met, I want to get everybody's reaction. Since Facebook several weeks ago, they banned Minister Louis Farrakhan. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They banned Alex Jones.
Right.
And several others.
Milo or my whatever.
Milo Yiannopoulos.
Milo Yiannopoulos. Yeah. So my question to you is, do you support that? Should people, no matter how offensive their comments might be, should they be banned from Facebook? Jeannie?
It's a private company. You can choose to use Facebook or not. So how we regulate it in the future is interesting. However, a ban, I mean, you're delving into who do you let go to your restaurant or not? In a way, right? Is everybody welcome to the restaurant that you have open for business, or is this a private club? I mean, I don't know where that stands.
What do you think, Michael?
Well, I tend to see this a little differently. I was delighted by Facebook's actions. I think hate speech leads to hate action. And there's a direct correlation between the speech and the action. And people who are out and out bigots of any sort, whether they're anti-Semites, whether they're racists, whether they're Islamophobic, whether they're xenophobic, you know, if the rhetoric gets to a certain level, I don't think they have the right to free speech.
How do we determine what is hate speech?
Yes.
Additionally here, the answer to hate speech is more speech.
Well,
I understand.
I've heard that a great deal.
Believe that.
But if Twitter had existed in the 1930s, could you imagine what the Nazis could have done with Twitter and with Facebook and Instagram?
Well,
so that scares me, and I will tell you, I mean,
but
I
have
don't
friends all the time getting banned for getting you know put in jail, Facebook jail all the time for comments or words that come up, and they don't even know why. It could be the abortion issue, it could be whatever.
It's a thorny dilemma. It really is. I mean, you look at Rwanda, for example. There was a proliferation of hate speech before that genocide.
And a lot of people are saying,
well, you know, that inflamed tensions in ways that were unnecessary. And so I think you have to be careful about that. But at the same time, you also have to understand the need for expression. And that contrary speech is sometimes the best.
You have to take action when the action occurs, though. That's the thing is, I think that the problem here is that there's sometimes a disconnect of getting the perpetrator once a criminal act actually occurs. That should be prosecuted immediately, taken care of, and everybody should know that's how it's going to be handled in the future. And so, if we had, I mean, look, there's no place that's more lawless than Chicago right now. with the whole Jussie Smollett stuff. I mean, it's serious okay. lawlessness. And that's okay. why you're maybe a little bit iffy about we need to knock down the hate speech because you're worried that it creates an action and that action isn't ever prosecuted. Look, if we have rule of law, we prosecute these actions, and then
Chris
you're
Robert.
Halfway there.
You want to weigh in?
I don't believe that Facebook or Mr. Zuckerberg is equipped to regulate speech.
Right.
And I think that speech is vital for democracy. I also think it's a social utility. I think that Facebook and the internet are social utilities now. And I think that they are, therefore, public accommodations.
Okay.
And so I think that, you know, we ought to view with great skepticism, in my humble opinion, efforts, what I consider to be a sort of authoritarian efforts to sort of we Facebook, parentheses, whoever the heck we Facebook is or are, end parentheses, say Smith here can no longer speak to people or Jones here can no longer. Because
right.
they're going to do that to Farrakhan today. None of us like Farrakhan. None of us like,
Alex
like Jones. Him. Okay, you might like
yeah,
him. But okay, many people don't like Farrakhan. Mm-hmm. I don't think Milo Yiannopoulos deserves to be banned. I think he's a agent provocateur. I think mm-hmm. he's
right.
sort of a wit and whatever. I've seen him on TV a few times. But anyway, who the heck is Facebook?
But look
to
at
make
Alex
these
Jones.
Decisions.
But I'm going to go to Salim, though.
Mm-hmm. The best thing here is competition, though. If you don't like what Facebook's doing, start your own
Facebook,
alternative.
Well, they felt under pressure.
But your point about Farrakhan.
They felt under pressure to do, especially since what happened in New Zealand, and it was broadcast live.
Right.
They were under extreme pressure to take some sort of action.
Right.
It's a bit ironic that the action they took was banning a Muslim, and what provoked them was an assault against Muslims. But that's an irony that you know we can discuss at another time. I think that Farrakhan is a nuanced situation. You know, most black people love Farrakhan. The least thing that they are concerned about is his so-called anti-Semitic teachings, and they are concerned.
So-called. Come
well,
on. They're not so-called. They are anti-Semitic.
Well,
come on.
I mean, he does.
Let us just...
He says...
When we come back, I want to pick up on that. I also want to get Michael's reaction. I want to get picked up on your assessment, analysis of Minister Louis Farrakhan. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for joining us tonight.
So,
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. We're having a heck of a show during the break. We should probably put that out on a separate pay-per-view. How about a pay-per-view version of Beyond the Beltway? Michael Bauer, Salim, I wanted to give you a chance to elaborate on your comments about Minister Louis Farrakhan.
Yeah, when he speaks about when he condemns certain Jews, he condemns Muslims in the same way. He condemns Christians in the same way. His point is that there are people who don't live up to their religious obligations, and they should be condemned for that. That's where he's trying to say. Well, no, I wouldn't say that. I mean, he verges on things that sound anti-Semitic. I think one of the reasons he's doing it, he's trying to rally the troops. That kind of defiance is an important
Michael
rallying
Bauer.
Point for a lot of people.
Now,
so I think he does that for that.
The words you hear bother you.
Well, but the words, it's one thing to say that you may not be conforming to your religion. When you start calling people of a certain religion termites, you know, that's really an ugly word,
yes.
right? And the problem is, it doesn't stop with that. The problem is what it may lead to. Because for someone like me, whose parents are Holocaust survivors, you know, I've heard that language before.
Yes, sir.
And I saw what it led to.
Well, that's the language that they had in Rwanda and Burundi.
Yes, that's true.
I mean, it was a similar language, and it was on a radio station. And to his everlasting credit, President Clinton pretty much wiped out that radio station.
Mm. So do we not have any shame anymore in this country?
Well,
is there no shame anymore? Do we not expose being said?
There's been no...
Give the historical context
about...
There's
been no evidence of Farrakhan's followers doing anything anti-Semitic. No attacks on Jews.
That's absolutely true.
There's been no attacks on any kind of Jewish establishment. Nothing at all.
Nor breaking the law.
Nothing.
At some point, though, how you are treated in the public sphere, how you are looked at in the public sphere should have some impact on folks like that. And it just doesn't anymore. It feels like anything goes.
Michael, I think I asked you this question a couple of months ago on the program. Is there a right to dislike Jews?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Where do you separate that from? When does that right, which you think people have, when does that become a borderline concern for that affects you insofar as what some of that rhetoric might lead to?
If someone doesn't want to associate with me because I'm Jewish, that's their prerogative. However, if someone wants to publicly denounce not just me, but the entire constituency of Jewish people as being less than people, less than worthy of life, you know, words like that start scaring me.
Salim, what's your answer to the same question? People who don't like blacks. Does everybody have to like blacks?
No, I would ask, why don't people like Jews? What's the reason for it? Is there some religious bigotry behind it or some religious motivation? Or why don't people like African Americans? I can come up with my
jealousy own could be one for Jews. There could be a lot of people who are jealous of Jews.
It could very well be.
Another reason is that there's just, you know, a lot of people say anti-Semitism is the longest historical bigotry that existed in the history of mankind.
Right.
And it just ebbs and flows, but it does ebb and flow. It never totally goes away.
But don't you think
isn't it a theological part of it
probably religious based. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, right.
Chris, you're weighing in on this issue, or are you just yawning?
I mean, look. It's very easy for us to dislike each other. It's very rewarding when we find ways to work together. And I think when people cross lines, and Michael used the example of the Nazi party in the 1930s, the Grand Mufti down in Jerusalem in the 1930s and the 1940s. When you, in my humble opinion, spokespeople, like for the Palestinians and what they have said. I don't think that you can look at the historic record of what Palestinian leaders have said about Israel and about Jews and find from the leaders, okay? I'm not talking about crazy people on both sides. I'm talking about you look at what Arafat said
about Jews and about Israel and the Jews.
And you look at what the leaders of Israel have said about the Palestinians and about Arabs, and I don't think there's a balance there.
What about the desire that we have now, Jeannie, that at least in political circles, you are obligated to denounce your enemy.
Right.
You've got to denounce them. You can't just say forget about them. I mean, their language. I mean, there's people. I mean, denouncing Donald Trump. Trump could say anything tomorrow, there will be a group that will demand that somebody denounce him. Usually a Republican. You got to stand up and denounce him.
No, I mean that it's just foolish. It's political pandering at its worst. And honestly, this entire last bit of this conversation we've had, the average American wants to know, make sure their kids are educated, the roads are working well. They know in Illinois, at least, the property taxes are too high. They want to make sure their kids have a job. They're worried about health care. And they don't walk around actually thinking that whatever Farrakhan said, on some site is bothering them.
Wait, the cops go to make an arrest,
and it becomes a mob scene, and they have to back off.
The problem in the black community is young black men. Can I please say something?
Jussie Smollett.
Young black men.
What does Jussie Smollett do?
killing other young black men. That is the issue.
Poverty is criminogenic. You look anywhere on the planet.
Yeah, because the unionized teachers.
The first way to combat poverty is with a job.
So what you have to do is erase the legacy of slavery that has restricted black people from any kind of participation in this economy for centuries, man.
We'll be back next
week.
You
know that.
Talk amongst yourselves.
I don't understand why. I have a hard time understanding how you can simply ignore that. I really do. That's what's amazing to me.
Huh? Because what you're saying is absolutely.